From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Split show for you tonight. Later on, will disclosure come soon? Stephen Bassett joins us. Here's what's happening. A bear unit will pay $750 million to settle claims with about 11,000 United States farmers who said a strain of the company's genetically modified rice tainted crops and ruined their export value. The settlement ends scores of lawsuits filed against the Bayer Crop Science unit of the company by farmers in Texas, Louisiana, Missouri, Arkansas, and Mississippi. The Agriculture Department said back in 2006, trace amounts of the company's experimental Liberty Link strain were found in long grain rice. Within 4 days, declining rice futures cost growers about $150 million, according to a complaint filed by the farmers. News of the contamination caused future prices to fall about 14%. Jeffrey Smith, the executive director of the Institute for Responsible Technology, and he is the leading spokesperson on the health dangers of genetically modified foods. Well, this proves exactly what you've been saying on this program, Jeffrey, for months now, that you can't control the spread of these genetically modified foods once they start blowing around.
That's right, George. The genes that we've released already could outlast the effects of global warming and nuclear waste. They can't contain it. They followed the USDA guidelines. They don't know how it contaminated. In fact, it hadn't been field trialed since 2001, but it had been discovered contaminated 5 years later.
How many fields do you think throughout this country? We're only talking about a few states in this lawsuit. But how many fields do you think might be contaminated with something?
Well, I think it was about 30% of the rice for this particular case. But you see, there's been about 50,000, more than 50,000 field trials in the United States by the USDA of between 1 and 200 different species. And they don't allow other people to even figure out how to test for what is being field trials. So we have no idea, for example, if wheat has been contaminated or rutabaga or other things. We just have to are going by faith, but our faith, of course, is not really in these companies or in their ability to prevent this kind of contamination, since it's what we've seen from the beginning.
So, Jeffrey, the monetary settlement, that's one thing. Good for those farmers. They probably could use it. But the contamination is another. That's going to go on and on and on, isn't it?
It's true. In fact, of course, it'll be dramatically less over time, but it's not going to be completely eliminated because this is an irreversible pollution of the gene pool. So, for example, there was a similar lawsuit when Starlink corn was discovered in the food supply in 2000, and it was just found in 22% of the samples tested by the USDA. After a $1 billion effort to recall it in settlements, it was still found 3 years later, but in 1.8% of the samples. So it shows that it's good to actually work to eliminate it, but we can't fully clean it up.
Okay, you'll find Jeffrey's website on our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. So not only do we have to worry then about contamination in the fields, but we also have to worry about just pollution and everything else that's going on this planet right now. Contaminated papaya appears to be the cause of an outbreak of salmonella in 23 states. According to the FDA, and they're warning consumers, the FDA said papayas imported from Mexico and distributed by a company called AgroMod Produce of McAllen, Texas, likely the source of 97 cases so far of salmonella to date, 10 people hospitalized, no reported deaths. The company has voluntarily recalled the papaya sold before July 23rd. I don't know how they can put a date on that, but that's the date they have. When I was very young, I always thought about the talk of budgets and debt crisis. Might have been some of the most boring things I've ever heard, but not anymore. Now I'm actually beginning to get a kick out of watching what they're doing in Washington, haggling over this budget crisis, the debt ceiling, and everything else. Matter of fact, the president went on national television just a few hours ago to try to tell Americans, help, I need some help here. Bombard your congresspeople, your senators, with emails. Tell them to cut a deal with us. Congress is at a stalemate over raising the federal debt ceiling, and Americans need to pressure their elected representatives, according to the president. This is his seventh primetime televised address, and he really is seeking to increase pressure for congressional leaders to reach a deal that would allow the government to continue borrowing money to pay its debts after August the 2nd. If Congress fails to raise the $14.3 trillion debt limit by August 2nd, there is a high likelihood that you could face rising interest rates, a declining dollar, among other problems. The cost of borrowing rises, mortgages go up, car loans go up, student loans, they go up. In an economy that's already teetering, we can't have that. Greg Hunter, with his website, of course, USAWatchdog.com. I think they'll cut a deal, Greg, but at what price?
George, I'm not so sure they'll cut a deal. We saw the Speaker of the House, the third most powerful man in government, Speaker of the House, because he takes over if the Vice President can't, and the President of the United States both give dueling speeches. You know what they were about? I'll sum it up in one word: stalemate.
Yep.
They both gave speeches on why they can't get anything done. I've been following this for about 10 days. When the stupid Murdoch case was on TV, ABC, NBC, CNN, HLN, Fox, Fox Business, Bloomberg, CNBC, MSNBC, all covering the stupid Murdoch thing. And just out of desperation, I went over to the House of Representatives on C-SPAN watching one-minute speeches about the debt ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man. At that point, I said, this is good. This is trouble. They're not going to get a deal through. George,
they're getting ready
to go over the waterfall, the Democrats and Republicans, and they're going to see who can hold their breath the longest on the other side.
It's like a chess match, isn't it?
This is the 2012 presidential election front and center. The president said, I'm not going to sign a short-term deal. He sent his White House chief of staff, Bill Daley, out to meet the press, and when he was asked by host David Gregory, so the president will veto any short-term
plan. But we lose.
Yes.
We lose.
Oh, well, yes. And then let me tell you. They're not going to default on our Treasury debt. That's a misnomer by the president. They're going to pay that in Social Security and the military. Hey, what about the Department of Education, TSA, USDA, FHA, Department of Health and Human Services? We've done this before.
All right, let's do a little side bet here, Greg. I say they do cut a deal. It's not going to be the best thing, but they're going to cut something temporarily. And you say no?
No.
All right. Let's find out what happened. Greg's website, again, that'll be part of our Twitter feed. All the news guests that appear in quick segments that you hear, we put their websites on our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. Our lengthier guests, show guests, guests for the hour or so, they're all linked up straight to the website. The company that makes BlackBerries, Research in Motion, they're slashing 2,000 jobs, 11% of its workforce, they are struggling. The man who bombed Norway's capital and gunned down youths on an island, killing at least 76 people, they downgraded that from 93, told police he intended to target the former prime minister. He just wanted her to go away. Amy Winehouse's funeral will take place on Tuesday. What a tragedy. Will be attended only by her family and close friends. A post-mortem on the Back to Black singer who died this weekend failed to determine how she died at the age of 27, and more toxicology tests are being carried out, the results expected in 2 to 4 weeks, conflicting reports about whether there were drugs in her house apartment or not. Some police in England say no, they didn't find any. Other people say there were. She bought a lot, so we'll find out. We'll find out. A South African health official says a man awoke to find himself in a morgue refrigerator nearly a day after his family thought he had died. Health department spokespeople say the man awoke Sunday afternoon, 21 hours after his family called in an undertaker who sent him to the morgue after they thought he died of an asthma attack. The man started yelling, prompted morgue workers. What did they do? Did they pull him out right away? No, they ran out of the morgue screaming because a body was talking. Then they came back later. He could have died. They eventually returned and removed him from the refrigerator. And I guess he's doing okay. There's an incredible story on the Huffington Post written by our friend Lee Spiegel. It has to do with the Betty and Barney Hill UFO abduction case, but it has to do with New Hampshire, the live free or die state. It's done something a little different for surprising UFO believers as well as skeptics. It has erected a historical marker commemorating the 50th anniversary close encounter of Betty and Barney Hill. Now, the Hill story, one of the most famous of all UFO experiences because it was the first widely reported UFO abduction report in the United States. I covered this story back in 1971, interviewing their psychiatrist, Dr. Benjamin Simon, who was out of Boston, about this case. And as he told me then, he said, George, they weren't lying. Now, I don't know what they saw or what happened to them, but they truly believe it. It's an incredible story. Here's Lee Spiegel with us. Lee, that's a great story, isn't it?
Well, it is, George. And just a couple of years after you spoke to Benjamin Simon, I met him in New York when he and Betty came to NBC because NBC had just finished putting the touches on the UFO incident, a made-for-TV drama starring James Earl Jones and Estelle Parsons. And they invited me to go to the screening with them. And I also asked probably the same questions that you did of Dr. Simon. And he said, you know what? They're not lying because of the way he did his hypnosis sessions. He wasn't trying to get them to make up any stories. He had a lot of experience with post-traumatic syndrome cases, soldiers coming back. And so he knew the kind of hypnosis that would at least be legitimate. He wasn't just a stage hypnotist. And it was amazing to go to that screening with them, and Betty cried through the whole show.
Lee, of course, writer, reporter, researches the unexplained, the paranormal, following ABC News. He's been writing for AOL News and now Huffington Post as well. How's all that coming along, Lee?
Really, really fine. You know, I'm the first person to admit that it's amazing to work for a major news organization that actually likes what I do.
I know it. Good for you. Keep doing what you're doing, Lee.
Will do. Thanks.
Appreciate it. And up next, Greg Little joins us. New discoveries in the search for Atlantis. And we'll also talk about the sleeping prophet, Edgar Cayce, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Dr. Greg Little, psychologist turned explorer, documentary maker. Since 2003, Greg and his wife, Laura, have been actively searching the Bahamas for archaeological ruins that might be linked to Atlantis and working with the Edgar Cayce Organization in its Search for Atlantis project. Greg's been on the show before, and here he is again. Hey, Greg, how are you?
I'm good, George. How are you?
Good.
Always a pleasure. Always a pleasure.
Likewise. And you have been doing some yeoman's work on this with your wife. Tell us about some of the new discoveries. What's happening?
Oh, my. Well, the Bahamas are actually a huge area. And Edgar Cayce, probably the greatest psychic of all time, really, he talked about Atlantis basically extending from Gibraltar all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. But in some of Cayce's psychic readings, and we'll discuss some of these shortly, I'll bet.
Yeah.
But he talked about the Bahamas in particular. And in that area, he said that a portion of Atlantis would rise in 1968 and 69. And we're coming to find that a lot of things were found in 68 and 69 that were sort of forgotten. And a couple of the things that we found recently, one is actually a genuine underwater building. It's actually the remains of a rectangular building. And it's really just off the shore of Bimini. Now, there's some real none of the information that I'm about to discuss has been released yet, and the Edgar Cayce Organization, which is called the Association for Research and Enlightenment, is about to send members out some news on this because we've been able to date the structure. It's actually the foundation of a rectangular building. It's about 45 feet long and approximately 20 feet or so wide. It has two large rooms. The outer walls are pretty much intact, and so far we've been able to find that they go down 4 feet into the sand. It's very rectangular, straight edges on the sides, and it's real clear that this is a man-made structure.
How deep in the water now, Greg?
It's 20 feet deep. It's in kind of an odd area.
Kind of shallow, isn't it, for that kind of water?
Very shallow, but keep in mind now that the Great Bahama Bank, which actually extends 300 miles, is real shallow. Most of it's only 10 to 20 feet, and it's very level, very flat. This is a real flat area. But the area where this structure was found is right off Bimini, and we believe it was found in 1969 by a fellow by the name of Count Tino Tirola, who was actually, He was a scuba diver, but he was more of a treasure hunter who got involved in the search for Atlantis back in the 60s when the first reports came out. But that structure, we think he saw, and it was almost immediately covered over with sand. The sand shift constantly there. They move back and forth, cover structures, uncover structures.
Mm-hmm.
And this thing was seen again in 2010 by a couple Bahamians who we work with. They contacted us and told us we needed to get down there and see it, and we did. And we got what I consider really phenomenal film and photos. Another ARE team went down and looked at it and took more measurements. They were actually there with the National Geographic about a year ago, and that show has not yet come out. But we were there about 2 months ago, and it's almost totally recovered with sand again.
Already?
Yep. So that's one structure. The other one is about 7 miles south of Bimini, and that one was a real surprise. There are scattered about in an area about 20 feet deep. It's actually it's elevated off the bottom because around this structure it's generally fairly deep, 30, 40, 50 feet. But then it gets elevated off the bottom in this long ridge. There are carved into the top of this ridge what look like square structures, steps, and scattered about are these huge slabs. And initially we were told they were granite, but we had a piece of it tested, and it turns out to be basalt. So it's not granite, and it doesn't appear to be indigenous to the Bahamas. But these big slabs are about 4.5 to 5 feet long, about 4 inches thick, and about 2 to 2.5 feet wide. So they're actually huge, huge, huge stones. There's about a dozen or so of those scattered around.
Do you think the landmass there, Greg, sank as opposed to the ocean levels rising?
You know, nobody really knows. I can tell you I've read a load of geological reports about it, and some people claim that it is rising. Others claim that it's falling, and some say it's never really moved. The rock around this is volcanic in origin. The rock where all these slabs of basalt are, that is volcanic. We've had that tested. And we were actually surprised by that because almost everything else there is limestone. So we know there's been some volcanic activity there. But we don't really know. I've read everything that goes from its rising to its actually falling to its never moved, and I don't really know who to believe with that. The only thing we know for sure is that the sea level, in fact, has risen in the past 10,000, 12,000 years, absolutely.
Sure,
it was at least 300 feet lower.
Well,
which brings me to the age of that building. That building is actually dated to 17,000 BC. It's 19,000 years old.
That is amazing.
It is absolutely amazing.
And that's very close to the period of Atlantis. We've heard periods from there to even 30,000 BC, haven't we?
Well, actually, Plato's Atlantis, Plato really talked about the end of Atlantis, and he talked about it demise in 9600 BC, but he never really gave any dates for the beginning of it. Edgar Cayce, on the other hand, gave a whole long story of Atlantis, which began in 210,000 BC.
Wow.
I mean, over 200,000 years ago. And he talked about it going through a series of destructions from 50,000 BC to when it sank around 10,000 BC.
And it was a very advanced civilization, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Plato actually talked about a very advanced civilization for 9600 BC, but Cayce's Atlantis talks about a very highly technological society that was destroyed several times and rebuilt itself. They did have flying machines, according to Cayce. They had submarines. They also had these power sources from crystals, and that's probably what excites people the most. But we really haven't found any evidence of the advanced technology. I mean, I'm just straightforward. We don't have any evidence of it. But Cayce said it was there. He said it was destroyed. And, of course, Plato said that it was a relatively advanced civilization for the time.
And what are the chances, Greg, that that technology scattered around the planet? I want you to think about that when we come back. Scattered around the planet. Maybe it went to Egypt. Maybe it went to areas in Central America. Who knows? Also, Greg has sent us a couple pieces of video that are posted at coasttocoastam.com if you want to go take a look at that. Some of those include those slabs he was just talking about. Another is a eerie plane wreck in the Bermuda Triangle. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment with Greg Little on Coast to Coast AM. Well, I went to Mark Zakrie's Twilight Zone companion book signing yesterday in Glendale and met a lot of Coast to Coast listeners from the L.A. area. Mark was duly surprised. We had a great time. His stepmother was there, too, unveiling her book. And we're going to get her on the show in the not-too-distant future to talk about things that she does as well. Anyways, we'll be back in a moment with Greg Little as we talk more about new discoveries and the search for Atlantis right here on Coast to Coast AM. Greg Little, where do you think the technology that might have been on Atlantis go? Did it go to Egypt? Did it go to Central America? Where did it go?
Well, Casey was pretty specific about that. He when he talked about the three destructions of Atlantis in 50,000 BC, 28,000, and 10,000 BC, he said that Atlanteans migrated off of the islands to a variety of places. That included all of the places in South and Central America where you find mounds and where you find pyramid structures, huge stone structures. All of those places are places where the Atlanteans went. They also went to the southwest of America in what we would call the Hopi lands or the Navajo lands, mm-hmm. and also other areas to the north. They went to Egypt. And yes, according to Casey, the Atlanteans merged with people that were already there and took their technology with them. They also went to the Gobi Desert. A small group went there. Others went to the Pyrenees Mountains, which is between Spain and France. And a few others just migrated to different spots here and there. But most of it went to South America, Central America, and Egypt. And according to Casey, they used that technology that the Atlanteans carried with them, built the pyramids, built all those structures.
How did the Atlanteans get so advanced?
Well, that's a good question. And you don't really see anywhere in either Casey's readings or in the things Plato said about Atlantis, you don't see how they really developed all that. Casey basically told us that they were very similar to us. Initially, they were thought forms that pushed themselves in to physical beings, and they evolved over time, according to Casey. They made conscious evolution, and they went through a series of root races and became increasingly intelligent. And as they became more and more trapped in this physical world, they actually took the physical world and started manipulating it to make their life more comfortable, just as we do. One of the things they discovered was basically energy, and they discovered it through crystals. They found that with certain kinds of crystals, they could focus the energy of the sun, and they could use that energy to, for example, heat gases and create steam.
Mm-hmm.
Casey talks about these huge gear machines where the steam or the gases would actually rotate the gears. He also says, though, that they were able to generate electricity, and they had radio communication. They had what sounds exactly like a modern laser, actually. And I don't know what to think about that. I just know what he said. I know that ancient technology came from somewhere. Personally, I think human beings were capable, as I understand humans, were capable of evolving and building that. But Casey says the Atlanteans carried their technology to all these other places.
The work of the Atlanteans, which Michael Cremo would probably say is civilizations that are just way older than we think. Did Casey ever talk about their involvement with extraterrestrials or anything like that?
Yes, there are a couple of Casey readings that are real specific about that, and then there's a lot of others that you could interpret that way. Excuse me.
Sure.
He talked about thought forms and entities that existed on other planets within other solar systems. He was asking one reading if there was any human life on planets in our solar system, and he said no. That's the only time anybody ever asked him something that straightforward. But, of course, that was just this solar system. They didn't ask him about anywhere else in the universe. That's one of the things that frustrates me. I wish people would have asked certain questions when they had the ability to. But most people were interested in their own problems in their own lives.
Yeah, and their health readings and things
like exactly.
That.
But the two readings that really focus in on it, one of them is very clear. There was some sort of a visitation. And one of the Casey readings talks about a visitation in the Maya lands in Central America. According to Casey, it happened after Jesus had lived on the earth. So it was sometime in the ADs, exactly when, it's very unclear when, but it was in the Maya lands. And it was some sort of a craft from some other world. The other Casey reading I'm even more interested in, and he talks about in 10,500 BC, the Atlantean priests were operating what he calls portals. And these portals were communication devices where they could speak with other intelligences from the outer spheres. That's his quote, the outer spheres.
Interesting.
And that doesn't sound like he means people here on Earth. It sounds like somewhere else, some other part of the outer space. Well, in 10,000 BC, one of the priests got a message through this portal, and he had a visitation. And that's what we don't know, if that visitation was from a craft or was it some sort of a mental message or a radio signal. We don't know. But that priest was told that Atlantis was about to be destroyed, and they need to make a plan to save some people, to migrate off the main islands, and also to create these three record halls, or halls of records as they're best known.
Which apparently Bimini, Central America, and the foot of the Sphinx, right?
That's it. Those are the three places. Somewhere around Bimini, one of the temples is. It's supposedly underwater. The one in Central America is in the Yucatan, which we believe is in Piedras Negras, Guatemala. We've been there. And the other is in Egypt, somewhere under the Sphinx near the right paw.
And the records all duplicated?
It's a set of tablets, 32 stone tablets, according to Casey, and it has the history of humanity from roughly 210,000 BC right up to the end of Atlantis.
Would you think it would echo, Greg, the Bible?
Well, a lot of what Casey said does echo the Bible. So, yes, I would say that a lot of it's very similar. Now, Casey got real specific about a lot of things that you just have to shake your head over. If you're completely tied to the Bible and you want to go with that as the historical record, some of what Casey said doesn't quite match that. He doesn't contradict it, but the dates are different. He gives different dates for different events.
Interesting. All right. Well, these Hall of Records, you know, Zahi Hawass, of course, booted out now as the head of antiquities.
Well, actually, Zahi's back as of right now.
As of when?
He was put back in. He was fired, or he resigned, but he was actually fired this weekend.
Right.
And
now he's back again?
Yeah, 24 hours later, there was such an upheaval that occurred. That Zahi was put back in. I know this is bizarre.
He's a rubber ball.
Yeah, this is the second time this has happened in very recently. He's put back, but Zahi has said he's going to stay only for a few weeks till they can finally find somebody else who can take over the position who will not cause so many problems. The person that was appointed after Zahi had his own problems. And so he immediately resigned, and the prime minister moved Zahi back in. But what he did do was demote Zahi from Minister of Antiquities down to the head of the Supreme Council of Antiquities. He just got rid of the minister position.
And they're going to let him retire with some dignity, I guess, right?
I don't know. I don't know what to say, but who knows?
I mean, but he's definitely leaving again.
He is leaving. Zahi has put out a message. He's also contacted the Casey organization. He's going to speak there in this October. October 6th through the 9th. And he has said he's definitely going to be there. He'll be retired then. He's looking forward to a life of scholarly pursuits and a quiet life as a private citizen.
Interesting. Well, you know, I like him with reservations, and let me explain that, Greg. I like him because in terms of being an excitable promoter of Egypt and the pyramids and things like that, he was one of the best. I mean, he was fun. He was a character jumping around with his hat on. But the reservations, he was very close-minded. You know, he didn't want to think about anything other than Egyptians, pure Egyptians built the pyramids. He refused to acknowledge or talk about the Hall of Records at the Sphinx. We've had a lot of people on this program that have said, look, we've done audio testing. There's something down there.
Well, there is.
Yeah, there's a tomb. There's something. Azahi doesn't want anything to hear about that unless he secretly went there and got it out.
I don't think he's secretly gotten it out yet. Zahi does have an interest in the Hall of Records. Zahi does have connections to the Casey organization that go back to his very beginnings. And it's known within the Casey organization what all the details about that are. Zahi is a friend of the ARE, but Zahi has a public face that he puts on, and his public face does not match the private Dr. Howard.
Well, and I would not know the private portion of him.
Well, very few people do. That's obvious.
I mean, would he change his tune about how the pyramids were built privately?
No, I don't think he can do that. I think that would he's doing a balancing act between people who are kind of saying that Egyptians didn't necessarily build the pyramids, and then he's got Muslim extremists that are there. And he's just got this tremendous balancing act that he's trying to pull off, but then his personality gets in the way. He's bombastic. He is very typical Egyptian male who is very domineering, does not like any dissent, and he is like a pharaoh. Zahi has been a pharaoh for a long time.
It's his own little kingdom.
Absolutely, and too much power does corrupt people, and that's what's happened to him. I don't mean corrupt in the sense that he's done a lot that's illegal, but the power has certainly shown in a lot of his egotistical behavior. I mean, Zahi, the thing about this that really bothers me, Andrew Collins has been on your show, and
yes.
I remember the last time I was on your show, I believe Andrew had just gone into the cave system under Giza. You asked me repeatedly on the show to talk about what was going on. I just wasn't able to because I was talking to Andrew on a cell phone at night from Egypt. He had gone in. Nobody else knew about it but a few people in the ARE, and everyone was afraid. He was actually physically afraid for himself.
Yeah, he was.
But okay, Andrew found the cave. There's a cave system that runs under the entire Giza Plateau. Collins found it. Zahi didn't know about it. Collins told Zahi about it. Zahi almost immediately issued a press release. It is still on his website today.
As if it were his story?
Well, he initially said, and his exact words, I can tell you there is no cave system at this time.
Oh, he denied it.
He denied it, and it's still on his website. And then he immediately ordered a crew in. This is a huge cave system. It is a lot larger than anybody realizes right now.
Is that where all the slaves hid, or what?
No, it's unclear what in the world this was used for. It's you had to break through a tomb to get into it. The tomb is one that the public just never went to. It wasn't closed off. It's just in an area that everybody forgot about. It's kind of an amazing story. This tomb and this cave system is not on a single map of Giza. It's like it disappeared. But Collins refound it. It was actually in 2008. His book on it came out in 2009. And this year, a documentary came out on it that I was involved with. But Zahi immediately sent a crew in. They cleared it out. They found that not only was there a tomb system there was a huge underground tomb, a huge chamber, probably one of the most incredible finds ever made on the Giza Plateau, other than the pyramids themselves. And then when he went in, he took that show Chasing Mummies, that entire crew from the show Chasing Mummies.
Yeah.
He didn't even know the cave system was there. The crew had contacted Andrew Collins, and Andrew told them how to find the cave
system.
That
is amazing.
And they actually showed Zahi where it was, and he was stunned. So they went into this cave system. They followed it for 350 feet, which is exactly what Collins wrote in his book. That's how long he went till he reached a much narrower tube. At that point, an archaeologist crawled in and went 30 feet in the tube, and then he got scared because it started splitting and going two directions.
Yeah,
you get lost. Back.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Zahi still says it's still on his site that this cave doesn't exist. But on the show, he said it was the greatest adventure he'd ever had at Giza. Going into that cave system, it's amazing. So that, I mean, we are frustrated by that too.
Greg, let me ask you about that video. You sent us a couple videos. One is of a sunken plane in Bermuda Triangle area. I'm a scuba diver. It's freaky when you're swimming and you come down upon something that has sank over the years. Everything's growing on it. I saw a car down there once during one of our training sessions. This is weird. Do you think the Bermuda Triangle and all the anomalies that have occurred in that region are based on the possible sinking of Atlantis?
You know, that's one of the theories. I honestly don't know. Here's what I do know. I know that, first of all, I'm almost certain that all those planes and ships and all that is there. We've found 29 planes so far. But I believe the planes are there. There is a mystery here, though. Why in the world do these planes, like they'll radio and say, we're coming in. We're 50 miles out from Miami. We're coming in. They're never seen.
Never seen.
Again.
They go the wrong way. Something happens.
Yes.
To them.
I mean, it's bizarre. Now, we had, the last time we were there, we had a very strange experience, actually two. But we have never had a weird experience. We go down in our own boat, but this past time we actually chartered two other boats, one to use as a base because we had to carry a lot of extra fuel. And we actually went out, there were three of us on our boat, and we couldn't see the water or the sky, and it wasn't foggy. It was like...
electrostatic?
I know the thing about the electric fog or
that green hue.
This was a sort of like that. It's just, we just couldn't see anything. It was really very eerie. And the guy we were with, the Bahamian that we always hire to go with us, he had never seen that either. He's had a lot of experiences where his compass will spin, where he goes the right direction to the right place at the right speed, and he winds up somewhere else. That's happened.
Could you feel it?
No, it was just strange. It was so odd running the boat into it. It was so odd, and we were, at that point, almost like a plane pilot who's going through a cloud, and we're just going on electronics. The GPS was still working fine, but it was odd. We really could not see anything but the water right around us, and it wasn't foggy. It's like everything just blended together.
I guess it could be an anomaly part of the planet, right?
It may very well be. I know people swear that there's weird things that happen there. I know strange things happen there. I've talked to enough people. We've only had that one, well, two events. I didn't talk about the other one. We've had these things occur to us, and I must admit, when we saw it, we filmed it, I can't tell. On the film, you really can't tell much because you really can't see anything.
No, but, you know, some people have said the ships, for example, get hit by these methane bubbles.
Yes, I believe.
And then
that.
They go right down like a rock.
Yes, I do believe
no
that has happened. Absolutely.
So, but the planes, that's strange because we have heard stories of, you know, their dials go nuts and everything else.
Right. And those aren't just stories. Those things are true. But I don't know what to make of it. I don't believe the planes are falling into a wormhole or going into another dimension
or getting gobbled up by a huge UFO.
Yeah, I don't, because I believe they're there. And in the shallow area where we've looked at a tiny percentage. Out of the 29 planes, roughly 25 of those are underwater. The rest we found on land. We know three of them are Bermuda Triangle planes on the official list for the Bermuda Triangle planes. And there's a couple that we're not sure. We have to go back and check them. And, of course, this one that is on your website now, that's a very eerie one. And it's strange. If you look carefully, you'll see the tail of a shark in the bottom of that plane.
I know. And I was going to ask you, why is it with every old crash like that, you never find the skeletons or the bodies? Do they get, like, eaten away and pulled away by fish? What happens?
Well, in that one, in that particular one, I believe that they got out. I don't think they survived because that's 120 miles from Bimini and 90 miles from Andros. The closest land is Andros, 90 miles.
So maybe they dove it into the ocean. Maybe they swam to the top, but then they died there.
Yeah, they're not. Yeah, you're not going to get to land from there. There's no way. The Gulf Stream's going to carry you up right through the center of the deepest area, and you're not going to make it. And that's a very, very strange plane, and it may have a strange story. We're hoping it does. The Coast Guard's gotten involved with it, and I don't want to give too many details because we're only 99% certain of its identity until we get to 100. It's just a strange-looking story. But why are there no bodies? All the planes that we found, we've never found a body, even crashes on land in really remote places.
Oh, yeah,
yes, they get in the ones that go into the water. Everything is destroyed by the carbonate process or eaten by either fish or sharks or some of the microscopic stuff.
Stay with us for phone calls, Greg, when we come back. Greg Little's websites, they're all linked up for you now at coasttocoastam.com. We'll talk a little bit more about the life of Edgar Cayce, the sleeping American prophet, and we'll take your phone calls as we talk about Atlantis, Egypt, and the Bermuda Triangle.